All right. Well, thank you very much. I learned this year that I am capable of preparing for a full course load on a couple weeks' notice, but I prefer not to do so. And so, no, I won't be taking you up on that next time around. Well, it's great to be here. It's great to be standing up here again and to have the opportunity to speak to you all again. This has been I have loved every sermon in this series, and so I'm glad to get to be a part of it. And the parable that I get to preach on this morning, the one that I want to focus on, I'll be preaching on the parable of the laborers in the vineyard or the workers in the vineyard, is one of my own favorites, has been for a long time. So it's a joy to me to get to speak on this morning. And as I do so, I want to begin by not simply reading the text, but reciting the text. And I would like to ask that you simply listen, because these parables are, after all, stories. And I think that Jesus' parables were meant to be heard as stories, and sometimes perhaps we perceive them better when we just listen to them, and rather than having our faces down in the book and reading words that we've read so many times that sometimes they lose their impact. So let me begin by just reciting this parable for us, and I'll just ask you all to listen. For the kingdom of heaven is like a landowner who went out early in the morning to hire workers for his vineyard. He agreed to pay them a denarius for the day, and he sent them into his vineyard. Then around 9 in the morning, he went out and saw others standing in the marketplace doing nothing. And he said to them, "You go into my vineyard too, and I will give you whatever is right." Then he went out again around noon and 3 in the afternoon, and he did the same thing. And at about 5 in the afternoon, he went out and found still others standing around. And he said to them, "Why have you been standing here all day long doing nothing?" "Because no one has hired us," they answered. He said to them, "You go into my vineyard too." Now, when evening came, the lord of the vineyard said to his foreman, "Call the workers and pay them their wages, beginning with the last ones hired on down to the first." And when those who were hired around 5 in the afternoon came, they each received a denarius. So when those who were hired first came, they thought they would receive more. But each of them also received a denarius. And they began to grumble against the landowner, saying, "These last ones worked only 1 hour, and you have made them equal to us who have borne the burden of the work and the heat of the day." But he answered one of them, "I have done you no wrong, friend. Didn't you agree to work for a denarius? Take what is yours and go. But I want to give the last one the same as I gave you. Am I not allowed to do what I want with what is mine? Or is it evil in your eyes that I am good? So the last will be first, and the first will be last." This is the word of the Lord. Well, again, throughout the course of this semester, we've gotten to hear a lot of great sermons on Jesus' parables. And among them, several weeks back, Dr. Roberts reminded us that the purpose of parables in general is to heal our spiritual misperceptions. And that, I think, is certainly true of this parable on many levels. This parable is perhaps a little bit like an onion that we have to peel back layer by layer. And with each layer, it brings deeper healing into our souls. Now, on the surface, this parable's, the details of this story are not really hard to understand, right? I mean, a landowner goes out and he hires workers for his vineyard, and he agrees to pay them what was the normal, typical, fair wage for a day's work. That's what a denarius was. It was the typical wage for a day's work. And then throughout the day, he goes out to hire more workers for his vineyard, right up until the last hour of the day. And so far, there's nothing particularly odd or unusual about this story. But the unexpected twist comes at the end when the landowner suddenly does something rather unusual. First, he decides to pay those who were hired last before those who were hired first. That's perhaps a little bit odd. But the really unusual and even potentially scandalous thing that he does is that he pays them all the same amount, regardless of how many hours they put in and how much work they actually did. And so now I just have a question for you all. How many of you currently have a job? Okay, a good number of you. How many of you have ever at any point in your life worked for an hourly wage? Okay, most of us, myself included. So now put yourself in the shoes of these workers. Imagine that you come in to your job and you do a full day's work, and then one of your coworkers comes in at the last hour of the workday, puts in 1 hour of work, and then the boss decides to pay you both the same amount, regardless of the fact that you worked a whole day and your coworker worked for 1 hour. How many of you would be upset by that? Okay, if you didn't raise your hand, you're lying. We all would be. Every single one of us would be upset by this because this is how we think. I do more, therefore I'm entitled to more. This is what we call fairness. And after all, in our culture, we compensate people for working overtime. And we consider it borderline criminal if somebody does more work than somebody else without also getting paid more for it. And so if we're honest with ourselves, all of us initially identify with the grumblers at the end of this story, do we not? But this is the first thing that this parable teaches us. The first lesson that this parable teaches us is that God's economics are not like ours. You see, the typical way that we think, and the typical way that our world operates is that I am compensated based on how much I do. I do more, I get more. I get more of a reward based on what I have earned. But the kingdom of God, Jesus tells us in this parable, does not work that way. God, it turns out, does not reward us on the basis of what we have earned. He doesn't reward us according to how much work we have done for him. And that, of course, is what we call grace, a word that is virtually synonymous with generosity in the ancient world. But the principle of grace necessarily means that God's economics are not strictly based on the idea of what is fair. Because the principle of fairness says, again, I get what I have earned. I get what I deserve. But grace doesn't care what you've earned or what you deserve. In fact, grace, as we will ultimately see in this parable, is telling us you haven't actually earned anything. You don't actually deserve anything. Everything you have is a matter of generosity. And now, of course, if we've grown up in church, or if we're theologically astute, we probably realize on some intellectual level that this is really good news for us, because after all, none of us actually deserve anything from God. But the question is whether we really believe that in our day-to-day lives, whether we've really allowed that truth to sink into our bones. More often, I think we really still want God to be fair to us. And we want God to be fair to us because we still think that we're actually entitled to something from him on the basis of what we have done for him. And we think that we deserve more than someone else who has done less. And it turns out that we're not the first to think this way. If we read closely through Matthew's gospel, we will see that actually Peter and Jesus' other disciples were also tempted to think this way. In fact, look back with me at about Matthew 19:27. And let's look for a minute at the immediate context in which this parable occurs. If those who have taken Gospels and Acts with me, you may remember that one of those five key points of how you should interpret a parable, how to interpret a parable well, is paying attention to the immediate context. So that's what we're doing. All right, Matthew 19:27. What we see here is Peter, in a moment where he is particularly upset with Jesus, because some things that Jesus has just said have led Peter to believe that Jesus might be saying that you're not actually going to be rewarded on the basis of what you've done for me. And so Peter asks him, Peter answers him in Matthew 19:27, "Look, we have left everything to follow you. What then will there be for us?" Jesus said to him, "Truly I tell you, at the renewal of all things, when the Son of Man sits on his glorious throne, you who have followed me will also sit on 12 thrones, judging the 12 tribes of Israel, and everyone who has left houses or brothers or sisters or father or mother or wife or children or fields for my sake will receive 100 times as much and will inherit eternal life. But many who are first will be last, and many who are last will be first." Notice that that paragraph ends with more or less the same line that our parable ends with. And then when we turn to the parable one verse later, it begins with the word "for." That's an unusual word to begin a story with, unless the story is actually meant to explain further what Jesus said in the previous paragraph. So it turns out that yes, this entire story, this entire parable that Jesus tells here is meant to explain what he means by many who are last will be first and many who are first will be last, and to further explain what he says to Peter and the other disciples in this paragraph. Now, what's going on here? Peter is thinking about everything that he has left behind, everything that has so far been sacrificed in order to follow Jesus. And essentially, he's saying to him, "Look, you better not be telling me that this is all for nothing. I better not have done this for nothing. We've left everything to follow you. What is there going to be in it for us?" And Jesus answers him with amazing gentleness, really. He begins by, on the one hand, reassuring Peter. "Peter, rest assured, you will have a reward. Everyone who follows me will have a reward. And you will not end up having left anything behind that you will not receive back 100 times over. But it won't be because of anything that you did for me. So be careful, Peter. Don't fall into that trap of thinking that your reward from me depends in any way, shape, or form on what you have done for me." And now let's think again about the story that Jesus tells Peter and the other disciples here. When we read this story, the Lord of the vineyard doesn't care how much work the workers have done. All that matters is that they came. All that matters is that they answered when he called. And it is the same with you and me. What matters is not how much you can do for God, not what you have done for him. Your reward will not be based on that. What matters is whether we answer obediently when he calls to us. After all, if we look at this story, read through the story a little bit more closely, we start to get the impression that the reason why the Lord of the vineyard hired all of these people in the first place never actually had anything to do with him or his own needs. I mean, why did he go out hour after hour throughout the day, right up until the last hour of the day when these people only had 1 hour of work left that they could actually offer him? Why did he keep going out to hire more people? It wasn't because he was in desperate need of their help. It was because they needed him. Calling them into his vineyard was never anything but an opportunity to be generous to them, to show them grace, to meet their needs, to care for them. The president, John F. Kennedy, once told the American people to ask not what their country could do for them, but what they could do for their country. In a manner of speaking, as it regards God, this parable is telling us to do the opposite. Not to think about what you can do for God, but to think about what he can do for you. But some people are actually offended by God's grace. We're offended by God's grace most often because we think that we deserve more than someone else who has done less. A professor of mine in undergrad used to, every year in one of his classes, write an exam that was almost impossibly hard. And yet, despite that, you would have a few high achievers who would manage to make an A anyway, but most of the students in the class would fail. At least half of them would, probably more than half. And it never failed that every year when he did this, those who did poorly I forgot the punchline of the story. What he would do is when he handed the exams back, everybody miraculously had a 100. Regardless of what they actually earned, they all had a 100. And he did this to illustrate for us the meaning of God's grace. But it never failed that every year when he did this, those who did poorly would be thankful, but there was almost always one student who made an A who would come to his office afterward to tell him off. Because he earned his A. He earned more than those other people who failed. He deserved that A. And this guy, what did he do? And this professor, what did he do? He made them all equal, just like the landowner in the parable. And sure enough, it makes people mad. But we get angry because we think, first of all, that we're entitled to something from God, and secondly, because we think that we deserve more than someone else. And it's at that point that we need to hear again the landowner's question toward the end of this parable in verse 15. What does he say? He says, "Am I not allowed to do what I want with what is mine?" What is mine? It's a subtle way of reminding us that actually nothing was ever ours. Everything in this whole world belongs to God. Everything that we have belongs to God. We were never actually entitled to anything. And everything that we have only by the generosity of God. But instead, we tend to get offended at times because we think that we are the first. We think that we are the first in this story when, in reality, all of us are actually the last. And if we understood for a moment how much generosity God has shown us, how much grace he has shown us, we would never begrudge in the slightest his equal grace to others. And so if we understand that, if we can get that far, then we are beginning to understand this parable. We've peeled back maybe the first layer or two of the onion now. But we haven't gotten to the heart of the matter just yet. See, at the very heart of this parable, what I believe it is really doing is telling us that our entire concept of what is just, our entire concept of what is right, is actually fundamentally wrong. Your whole concept of what is right is fundamentally wrong. See, from start to finish, this parable actually calls into question whether we really know what is just or what is right at all. And this really begins to happen around verse 4 in the parable. You see, when he goes out to hire this second group of workers, notice what he says to them. He says, "You go into my vineyard too, and I will give you whatever is right." Now, that's not what he said to the first group. To the first group, he promises them a specific amount. He promises them each a denarius, which was, again, the normal fair wage for a day's work. But to the second group, he doesn't promise any particular amount. He just says, "I will give you whatever is right." And now, when we hear that, whatever is right, most of us instinctively think that what is right means what is fair. And some English translations even translate it that way, but the NIV gets it exactly right here, no pun intended. The word there is, in Greek, is dikaios, a word that can variously be translated just or right or righteous, all of which were kind of one and the same concept in the ancient world. And it's a very important word to Matthew. Matthew uses this word more than any other writer in the New Testament other than Paul. But Paul has 13 letters, so, you know, he had more opportunities. But in any case, by making this statement, with this statement, I will give you whatever is right, the landowner implicitly raises the question for us, well, what is right? What is just? What is right anyway? And our assumption tends to be that what is right equals what is fair. But is that what the parable really says in the end? You see, this question actually reappears for us, in a manner of speaking, toward the end of the parable in verse 13, although we wouldn't necessarily know it from most translations. But in verse 13, how does the landowner defend himself in response to his disgruntled employees who are now angry with him? He says, what does he say? He says, I have done you no wrong, friend. Not as many translations, including the NIV this time, have it. I'm not being unfair to you, but very literally in Greek, I have done you no wrong. I have done you no injustice. The word used here is the exact antonym in Greek of dikaios back in 4. So we are talking very much here about the difference between justice and injustice. Right versus wrong. And this is exactly the landowner's point, after all, that he has not actually done wrong to anyone. He hasn't done injustice to anyone. He hasn't done ill to anyone. He did, after all, give them exactly what he promised to give them. They agreed to work for a denarius, and they got a denarius. He hasn't actually slighted anyone in this story. All he's done is to be especially generous to some, by meeting their needs, giving them the wage that they needed to live their lives, in short. But in doing so, in being so generous, he has not actually slighted or taken away from anyone. And after all, as he says in verse 15, it's his money. Is he not allowed to do what he wants with it? But then the real punchline of the parable comes with that final question. The last question in the parable. Or is it evil in your sight that I am good? Again, that's a very literal translation. Not just are you envious because I am generous, but literally, is it evil in your eyes that I am good? In other words, do you see the goodness that I am doing to others and call it evil? Are you calling my goodness evil? Is your moral compass so off that you see, and that when you see actual goodness, you think it's evil? What he's saying to them, in a way, is, don't you see, I promised these people that I would give them what is right, but I don't define what is right the same way that you do. You define what is right as what is fair, which means everybody gets what they have earned. People get what they deserve, and some people necessarily get more than others. But God's justice isn't like that. He doesn't play by our rules. He doesn't confine himself to our standards. Instead, in God's justice, what is right is not giving people what they deserve, but simply doing what is just, plain good to them. Whenever I read this question at the end of the parable, or is it evil in your eyes that I'm good, I cannot help but think of Isaiah 5:20, woe to those who call evil good and good evil. But that is what we so often do. We call God's goodness evil when we become offended at his grace because we think that we deserve more than someone else who has done less. And so Jesus' parable exposes us in the end. It exposes our entire concept of what is right and what is just as a sham. But it is in exposing us that it also begins to bring healing into our souls. He exposes our graceless hearts in order to fill them with grace after all. And so the final lesson then that this parable teaches us is that God's righteousness is a righteousness that makes right, that actually makes things right, which means that true righteousness consists in making things right, in actually doing good. True justice and righteousness do not consist in giving people what they deserve, but rather in repairing things, restoring things, making things right, doing whatever good is in your power to do to others. Again, it makes me think of Psalm 85:10, love and faithfulness meet, righteousness and peace kiss each other. God's grace is the place where righteousness and peace kiss each other. In his grace, they become one, and they become one for us. So, what then does this parable finally say to us on a practical level? Well, I'll tell you what it says to me, or at least some of what I think it says to me. To begin with, it liberates me, because it reminds me that neither my worth to God nor my reward from him depend on anything that I can do for him, anything that I have done or ever will do for him. And that is good news. That is liberating news. But this parable also challenges me, because the flip side of that very statement is that nothing that I do for God entitles me to anything from him, nor am I any more deserving than anyone else. In fact, it forces me to remember that I myself have been the recipient of boundless grace, just like anyone else, as much as anyone else. And so how could I, why would I begrudge him showing that same grace to someone else? And then finally, this parable challenges me to see others as God sees them. As the German commentator Edward Schweitzer said of this parable, we must learn to see with the eyes of God and no longer with our own evil eyes. Until we learn to see ourselves and one another with the eyes of God rather than with our own evil eyes, we will not have understood this parable. Until we learn to see ourselves and one another with the eyes of God, we will not understand true justice or righteousness. And until we learn to see ourselves and one another with the eyes of God, we will not understand God's grace. And so I'll close by quoting just one more German. Adolf Schlatter, who was one of Dietrich Bonhoeffer's teachers, and said of this parable, "The last become first through no merit of their own, and the first become last by opposing grace." If we insist that we are the first, we will become last in the kingdom of heaven. But if we have the spiritual sight to see that we are all actually the last, then we will receive God's grace with gratitude, and we will also rejoice at his grace to others. And we just might find ourselves among the first after all. I will close now with a benediction from 1 Thessalonians 5:23 through 24. May God himself, the God of peace, sanctify you through and through. May your whole spirit, soul, and body be kept blameless at the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ. The one who calls you is faithful, and he will do it. Amen.